the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the session on microbicide development. And I'm Zita Rosenberg from the International Partnership for Microbicides, and I will be co-chairing the session with our first speaker, who I will introduce at the same time so we can save some time. This is Robin Shattuck from St. George's Hospital Medical School in the UK, and he will be opening up with a 15-minute overview of microbicides.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak to you today. I'm going to give you a really very rapid tour of the microbicide development field, a field that is really growing at a very fast pace and is also growing in terms of public interest and popularity. So yesterday, Geeta Ramji gave a very fine talk, really positioning HIV prevention technologies and microbicides and the urgent need for female-initiated preventive measures. So I'm going to take that as read and really stick to the science this afternoon. So where do microbicides fit in terms of HIV prevention? Well, they can be considered, depending on the way they're delivered, either a technology that's used at the time of exposure or perhaps a technology that can also be used prior to exposure. And I think the field is rapidly moving to sustained long-term protection and mechanisms that may provide that. So what are microbicides? Essentially, these would be substances that could prevent or reduce HIV transmission when applied to the vagina or the rectum. They may also be active against other sexually transmitted diseases. And the field is looking at developing and delivering this technology in as many different forms as possible to provide choice to those people who want to use it. However, in terms of product development, the first products that are in clinical trials are based on gel formulations, essentially because this is the easiest way to do it and the fastest thing to get into clinical trials. But there are a number of groups working on different delivery strategies, ultimately to provide as many options as possible. We're trying to match the mechanisms of transmission to the action of the microbicides. And again, this is an evolving science, but we're getting nearer to understanding how the virus can get across stratified epithelium, the first targets it interacts with, and also how it might get across columnar epithelium, represented by the endocervical canal and also the rectum. Again, while we're learning more quite rapidly, this is an area that can't be ignored and still requires more research effort. And we know both from in vitro modeling and macaque modeling that the time for intervention is relatively short. Infection can be established in a mucosal environment within minutes and is probably disseminated to draining lymph nodes in a period of hours to days. There are a variety of different approaches that a microbicide could adopt in order to prevent HIV, ranging from the very simple in terms of just reducing the chances of microtrauma that may provide a window for virus to gain access to susceptible cells, through to more sophisticated interventions that block different steps in the viral life cycle. Now, I'll address some of those in my talk today, but they're addressed in more detail in yesterday's edition of PLOS Medicine, which is now available online. So there are four key rules in terms of microbicide development that must be adhered to. The first is safety. Clearly, a microbicide is going to be used by a population that is healthy, and it must do no damage to natural barriers that may prevent or at least reduce the risk of transmission. It must be highly effective, and the field is moving rapidly to use more and more potent inhibitors of viral transmission. But it also must be a cost-effective strategy. This means high-tech, expensive solutions are never going to make it in the real world. And it needs to be user-friendly because it doesn't matter how good it is. If people don't want to use it when they're having sex, it isn't going to be effective in a real-world situation. When we think about safety, we need to think about it being used by those of women that are most at risk. So not only women with a healthy reproductive genital tract, but also young women who may have cervical ectopy, where the endocervix, the single columnar epithelium, grows out onto the ectocervix, providing a much more fragile barrier to the virus, but also a more fragile surface that a microbicide may be applied to. And also, these intervention strategies need to be effective in the presence of other either inflammatory or ulcerative sexually transmitted diseases. The good news is that there are a number of products already in phase 3 trials. These phase 3 trials are due to finish in 2008 and 2009, and so we will have the first understanding of products that have gone all the way from preclinical evaluation into clinical trials. Thereby, they will inform subsequent clinical trials of more potent drugs. There are a number of other drugs that are pushing hard on the heels of these first generation products, and then further back in the pipeline, there are a lot of different concepts that are potentially being developed and combination strategies. If we think about targeting the virus, this summarizes some of the approaches that are being considered. There are a number of different targets that can be targeted by different compounds or combinations. But in terms of their use as a microbicide intervention strategy, the key thing is that these compounds need to be present at the site of infection. This slide shows a gadolinium-labeled microbicide product that has been instilled vaginally, and you can see that there's good coverage of the cervix and throughout the vaginal lumen. But this needs to be maintained at the point of viral exposure. This means it needs to be applied before intercourse, it needs to be maintained at protective levels when the individual is exposed to the virus. The alternative strategies to target the susceptible cells themselves in the mucosal tissue, and again, there are a variety of different approaches that are being explored, some of them really quite successfully. Again, here, the key to success is getting the drug to those target cells in time to protect the target cells and maintaining it there for as long as infectious virus may reside in that environment. So what about the first generation microbicides? Essentially, most of the microbicides are based on a polyanion charged compounds that block viral attachment. There are also acid buffering gels that may work by reducing vaginal pH, and surfactant C31G that may disrupt the virus. The majority of these are safe, they're very cheap, they're user-friendly, and fairly broad, have broad activity in that they have a range of activity against other sexually transmitted diseases. However, for all of these products, there is no published data showing efficacy in animal models. So at the moment, we do not have robust animal model data to give us confidence that they may or may not work. And while their broad activity is an advantage, it also has a trade-off in that it may reduce their potency when compared to second and third generation drugs. Also, these are coitally dependent products, and so they have a high compliance burden. This means in terms of a trial setting, we need to make sure that these products are used every time that an individual is having intercourse. If we think about the polyanions, and in terms of their activity, we know that these polyanions are particularly good at blocking X4 viral infections because of the high native charge expressed on GP120. However, their interaction against R5 viruses is mediated by blocking the attachment of the virus to the target cell. This means the drug needs to be delivered to the susceptible targets within the mucosal tissue. This is a concept that we have not been able to try in animal models, but has been tested quite extensively in vitro models. And if you want more details, some of this has been addressed in a recent publication in Retrovirology. Moving to second-generation microbicides, people are actively looking at the use of antiretroviral drugs. The ones that are currently being in the development pipeline are PMPA or tenofovir, and three different types of NNRTIs, all of which are highly potent and are highly highly hydrophobic drugs, and so they have poor oral absorption. But this may be an advantage for mucosal administration because they have relatively low systemic absorption, or potentially no systemic absorption when they're applied vaginally. Again, these are safe and cheap and highly active and could be formulated for sustained release, and I'll talk about that more in a moment. Their potential disadvantages is there is a potential perceived risk of resistance development, although that has been untested, and they have a lack of activity against other sexually transmitted diseases. Both of these could be overcome by creating combination products. Again, all of these require proof of concept studies in animal models, and there is no robust data at the moment to show that whether they have ability to block transmission or not in a mucosal situation. One of the interesting things with the NNRTIs that are currently being developed is because of their hydrophobic nature, they have a very long tissue residence time. This is data showing sequential challenge studies following a two-hour pulse of mucosal cervical tissue with the drug and then challenging on consecutive days. What the data shows in summary is that you can still provide protection up to 6 days post-drug treatment. Now, clearly, this is an in vitro model. We don't know whether this will extrapolate to an in vivo situation, but you can see it starts to move to developing products that may not require coital-dependent use. And then perhaps slightly further behind in the development pipeline are the use of entry inhibitors as microbicides. The ones that have been studied the most are compound 167, a CCR5 antagonist, the BMS-806 compound that binds to GP120 and renders the virus non-infectious, and PSC-Rantes, a highly active analog of Rantes that blocks CCR5 and causes internalization. Again, these are highly active and potentially could be formulated for sustained release. Their disadvantage is that they lack activity against X4 virus and lack activity against other sexually transmitted diseases. Again, this could be overcome with combination products. So what have we got in terms of proof of concept in animal studies? Well, in fact, the number of studies are relatively limited. We know that monoclonal antibody B12 can block infection, but it's probably too expensive to be developed. Cyanovirin seems to block very well, both rectally and vaginally, when it's used in macaque models. The BMS compound has shown some potency. Pro-2000, which is in clinical trials, has been shown to be very effective against X4 virus, and we're awaiting studies to be carried out against R5 virus. And then the CCR5 antagonists, compound 167 and Rantes, have both been shown to be highly effective in challenge studies. The field is looking very actively at developing combinations, both in terms of looking for synergy of activity, but also to increase the breadth of activity and reduce the chances of resistance development. The disadvantages is that at the moment there's an unclear regulatory pathway and the trial design would be far more complex. However, people are actively working to try and push combinations as fast as possible. We know that in in vitro animal model presented by John Moore yesterday, that in fact, if you increase the number of inhibitors, you can very dramatically increase the activity of drugs, again, giving good evidence that combinations will be more effective. We've also been looking as a field at whether rectal microbicides can be developed. This is summarizing some data looking at rectal microbicides in tissue explants, colorectal tissue explants, showing that Pro-2000 and UC781 can show very good activity, and that cyanovirin here also can reduce viral infection. And cyanovirin is the only one so far that has been demonstrated to block infection in the macaque model. Interestingly, this has now been developed by the EMPRO European Microbicide Project for expression in plants, and so this provides the first opportunity for mass production of these products. And then some more interesting studies that were presented at the Microbicide 2006 conference by Martin Cranage and Ian McGowan and Peter Anton's group, looking at using PMPA, the vaginal gel, but instilling it rectally and showing that there was a degree of protection in macaques, and looking ahead at really more blue sky intervention strategies presented by Dean Hammer, looking at recombinant E. coli that expressed a GP41 fusion inhibitor and again showed some activity. So how will they be used? The field at the moment is concentrating on coitally dependent products in terms of those things in clinical trials, but it's rapidly looking at sustained release devices. Now this has big impacts in terms of cost. If we look at a coitally dependent product, you will probably need to produce on average 100 units a year, and the cost, net predicted cost based on manufacture for phase 3 trials is likely to be in the region of $60 per person per year. If it was a once-a-day gel, you're looking at $219 per person. And you can see the comparison in terms of rings on a 30-day or a 90-day ring product. This doesn't include the cost of distribution of these different products. Now, proving efficacy is going to be extremely difficult because these do require very large trials. And so the field needs to be very smart in triaging those products and those concepts that get into clinical trials. There are a number of challenges that still need to be addressed by the field. We need to work on rational drug development to select the best and push them as fast as possible. There needs to be greater access to animal models for comparison of different concepts and different formulations. There needs to be more emphasis on combinations. We need to look at technology that can reduce the compliance burden, both to make the trials easier, but also to make them user-friendly. There's still a great need to increase the clinical trial capacity because there is not enough trial sites to do the trials that need to be done. And then the field needs to look at how it integrates with other prevention strategies because it's going to get busier and busier as different approaches show different degrees of efficacy. And on that point, I'd like to finish and thank all the research staff, collaborators, and funders who help to support my work. Thank you.
We should have time for a few questions. So if people want to come up to the microphone, please. No? Okay. Well, we might be catching up. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is just, are they all contraceptives as well, and how are you going to deal with that if so? Because many women want to have babies as well.
A very good question. I didn't have time to cover that aspect. There are some products that do have contraceptive activity, but the majority don't. So the field will definitely look to develop both contraceptive and non-contraceptive products.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks, Robin. Now, I was going to introduce our next speaker, but I'm not sure if he's here. Is Osman De Cruz in the audience?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, you should be up here. Well, come on up. You're next. I'd like to introduce the next talk by Osman De Cruz on contraceptive and non-contraceptive thiourea, non-nucleoside inhibitor-based anti-HIV microbicides.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenberg, the members, ladies and gentlemen. The emergence of AIDS as a disease spread through sexual intercourse has prompted the search for safe and effective vaginal as well as rectal microbicide to curb the mucosal transmission of HIV via semen. Thus far, three critical points in the viral life cycle have been the focus of, have been the target of 21 anti-HIV drugs in clinical use. Sorry. The fusion inhibitors block the initial attachment of the virus to immune cells. The reverse transcriptase inhibitors such as nucleoside analogs as well as non-nucleoside inhibitors block inhibit inhibit the transcription of viral RNA to viral DNA by reverse transcriptase, and the protease inhibitors prevent the processing of GagPol protein by the HIV protease. The non-nucleoside inhibitors have emerged are an important arsenal against HIV. One, they have emerged as promising microbicide because of various properties. They are chemically diverse hydrophobic compounds comprising over 30 different classes. They have been found to be key components of effective combination regimens. Despite their chemical diversity, they bind to a common allosteric site and non-competitively inhibit DNA polymerization. The current non-nucleoside inhibitors in clinical use have low genetic barrier, since single amino acid changes in the binding pocket can directly affect drug binding. Nevertheless, extensive structural studies, molecular modeling, and computer-aided design, as well as chemical synthesis, has led to the generation of second generation of potent non-nucleoside inhibitors active against both drug-sensitive as well as multi-drug-resistant strains of HIV. Consequently, several non-nucleoside inhibitors are in preclinical and clinical development, especially as potential microbicides. We have developed a novel composite binding pocket of HIV-RT, which was constructed by superimposing the crystal structure of 9 individual non-nucleoside inhibitor enzyme complexes. This composite binding pocket shown here has a butterfly-type structure with wing 1 and wing 2 region overlaid with the amino acid residues adjacent to the wing 1 and wing 2 structures. The binding pocket is shown as grid lines representing the collective van der Waal forces. We found that individual currently used non-nucleoside inhibitors are highly inefficient because of they do not completely fill the molecular volume that is required for effective binding and inhibiting the reverse transcriptase. So only the tight binding non-nucleoside inhibitors are endowed with microbicidal activity mainly because of their ability to cross membrane barriers, irreversibly inhibit HIV-1 reverse transcriptase activity. They have rapid virucidal activity without metabolic activation, and they are stable under acidic as well as various climatological conditions, do not perturb the vaginal mucosa as well as normal flora, and lack systemic absorption to minimize drug resistance. We have rationally designed several thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors using the PET phenethyl thiazolyl thiourea compound and trovodin as the model system. We found that based on the non-nucleoside drug resistance, we could find changes in the binding non-nucleoside binding pocket shape, volume, and chemical makeup with the PET non-nucleoside inhibitors. Consequently, we have rationally designed several non-nucleoside inhibitors with high affinity for the enzyme by replacing the pyridyl ring of trovodin with either phenyl ring or the phenyl ring in PHI 236, cyclohexanyl ring in PHI 346, or a thiophene ring in PHI 443, as well as several functionalization of the phenyl ring with several substitution, in this case 2,5-dimethoxy groups. And this is this illustrates the binding mode of thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors. These rationally designed non-nucleoside inhibitors fit very well within the molecular volume of the binding pocket, with one part residing in the wing 1 and the other part residing in the wing 2. This is PHI 236 with the phenyl wing with additional substitutions of 2,5-dimethoxy, and this is PHI 346, which fit in the wing 1 and the wing 2 region of the butterfly-shaped binding pocket, having a cyclohexanyl ring. Consequently, these thiourea nucleoside inhibitors have high binding affinity based on their lower Ludi Ki value as well as lower IC50 values for reverse transcriptase inhibition as well as HIV replication based on P24 values. There's a high correlation indicating high affinity for the reverse transcriptase. As a result, when we tested the anti-HIV profile of these thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors, we found potent activity as expected when compared with the clinically available non-nucleoside inhibitors, nevirapine, delaverdine, or the experimental non-nucleoside inhibitor, trovirdine, which was used for docking and rational design of novel thiourea inhibitors. The thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors were highly potent against the drug-sensitive strain at nanomolar concentrations. It was highly active against the problematic double mutant, which is highly problematic for non-nucleoside resistance in patients. It was highly active against multi-drug resistant strains, as well as genotypic or phenotypic drug resistance isolates, non-B-type isolates originating from South America, Asia, and sub-Saharan Africa with 2 to 7 reverse transcriptase gene mutations. To be an efficient vaginal as well as rectal microbicide, the anti-HIV drugs need to be formulated adequately to have good bioadhesion as well as bioavailability of the drug. We have developed a microemulsion-based vaginal drug delivery vehicle as an efficient formulation for both spermicidal non-nucleoside inhibitors. The gel microemulsion itself imparts spermicidal properties. So non-nucleoside inhibitors formulated in gel microemulsion are contraceptive microbicides. This colored area, the microemulsion is comprised of water, oil, and non-toxic surfactants. The colored area represents the single-phase microemulsion that was used for formulating non-nucleoside inhibitors. This microemulsion region imparts contraceptive activity because of its intrinsic spermicidal property. We have tested 3 representative thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors against the mouse model of AIDS, that is the severe combined immunodeficient mouse model for vaginally transmitted HIV-1. In this case, three representative thiourea non-nucleoside were tested ex vivo, that is, they were pre-treated with HIV-1 infected, R5 HIV infected human leukocytes in the presence of human semen, then vaginally inoculated. In the case of PHI 346, we applied the gel in vivo and then inoculated vaginally with HIV infected cells in the presence of semen. 14 days after single inoculations, mice were euthanized and scored for plasma RNA levels as well as spleen for RNA copies. As you can see, when compared to the vehicle, there is significant reduction of protection from systemic infection by a single intravaginal inoculation. suggesting that these tight-binding non-nucleoside inhibitors can directly inactivate HIV-1, as well as can prevent HIV-1 replication within the genital fluids in the vaginal wall. We have done extensive preclinical studies using mice, rabbits, and pigs as the model system. We have done intravaginal, intraperitoneal, as well as intravenous studies. The thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors are lack mucosal toxicity in the porcine and the rabbit model systems. They have high selectivity index against leukocytes as well as human genital epithelial cells. We have done 13-week intravaginal toxicity studies as well as 13-week consecutive application of these gel formulations at 3 doses and found to lack reproductive toxicity in terms of fertility and pup development. We have developed the gel microemulsion as a spermicidal contraceptive and non-emulsifying gel formulation as a non-contraceptive formulation for thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors. As stated by Dr. Shattuck, these thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors have minimal oral bioavailability, less than 2%. And when they were administered intravenously or intraperitoneally, greater than 40% was bioavailable with favorable pharmacokinetics, yet they were non-toxic. Thus, in conclusion, rationally designed thiourea non-nucleoside inhibitors deduced from changes in binding pocket size, shape, and amino acid residue character display broad-spectrum anti-HIV activity. Thiourea non-nucleosides are more potent against drug-sensitive as well as multidrug-resistant strains of HIV than the 3 classes of non-nucleoside inhibitors currently in clinical use. They are stable, retain antiviral activity as well as in vivo microbicide activity, and lack systemic as well as mucosal toxicity. Consequently, they are useful as topical virucides to prevent the sexual transmission of HIV-1. Thank you.
We have time for some questions. Please go to the microphone.
Bergeron, Canada. Can you tell me about the anti-contraceptive effect of your drug?
Yeah,
you mentioned it in the slide, but how does it work?
We don't know the mechanism, but basically we have found bromomethoxy-substituted nucleoside in aryl phosphate derivatives of zidovudine, that is AZT, as well as bromo-substituted cyclohexanil non-nucleoside inhibitors, bromopyridyl thiourea. They impart spermicidal property, which can be further amplified using a microemulsion-based formulation.
I think we have a question over here first, and then we'll come back.
Gustavo Loncel, Eastern Virginia. Osmond, you tested this. The efficacy in animal models is only from the skeet mouse model, which, as you know, is a cell-associated, and it's relatively or significantly artificial in its properties. Have you and I know that you've tested previous compounds in the FIB feline model, and so I wondered if you have any data on efficacy in animal models that is not from the skeet mouse.
Non-nucleoside inhibitors are not active against the FIV model.
How about, you know, the RT? Have you explored, or are you intending to test this in an RT shift?
We plan to use in the SHIV model.
Thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you.
Can you elaborate a little more? Did you learn anything about the systemic absorption of these molecules in the animal models?
Yeah, we have published the pharmacokinetics of 3 thiourea inhibitors, and the pharmacokinetics is favorable as expected. Micromolar concentrations can be achieved in the plasma, which is several fold higher than that's needed for inactivation.
Let me clarify then. In the Skidmouse model, you introduced this vaginally.
Yes.
Was there systemic absorption in that delivery mode?
No, we didn't check because it was the amount that was used for treatment was conspicuously small compared to pharmacokinetic studies, where we used from 40 milligrams to 400 milligrams per kg.
Okay, thank you.
And then just two more questions.
Walter Strauss, U.S. You actually presented a little data on reproductive toxicology. That made me, if I could, a question for Dr. Shattuck. About more generally, if either of you could comment upon the whether these products that are in development are safe from a reproductive standpoint, in other words, free of teratogenic effects, what's known?
We have tested for up to 13 weeks of daily intravaginal application at the maximum concentration that can be formulated in the gel microemulsion and found to be non-toxic. All the organs from the mice were evaluated by the histopathologist and found to be non-toxic. Then half of the mice were mated with the males, untreated males, and the pup development was followed for 5 days after delivery, and based on their weight, there was no reduction in pup weight, and they were healthy.
So working up full reproductive toxicology is part of the development package for all of these microbicides. And is the full package is completed by the beginning of phase three, but a lot of it is done earlier than that.
Okay, so really limited information is available right now, right?
Well, for the ones in the phase three trials, there's complete information.
Mm. Hi, can you evaluate the cost effectiveness of your system relative to female or male condoms?
Thiourea's are pretty cheap to make. The synthetic procedure is simple, and they are relatively cheaper compared to non-nucleoside inhibitors. I mean, compared to nucleoside analogs.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
So our next speaker is Joe Romano from the International Partnership for Microbicides. And he's going to talk to us about the characterization of in vitro release and in vivo delivery of TMC-120.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you for your introductory comments. That'll serve as background for my talk. Also, gratitude to the organizers for the opportunity to speak here today. It's clear that potency, the capacity of a microbicide candidate to inhibit HIV replication or transmission of HIV is one of its most important properties. However, anti-HIV activity alone does not a microbicide make. Just as important is how that antiviral agent is formulated. What is its final drug product configuration? Conventionally, the microbicide field has started microbicide development with gel formulations, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. But the field is maturing and is learning from the contraceptive field, where there are more than one type of drug product formulation that are available for contraceptive agents. And the microbicide field is beginning in a meaningful way to explore those options as well for the delivery of anti-HIV drugs. On this slide, there's a listing here. There are various forms of semi-solid and solid delivery systems. In the previous talk, you heard about emulsions. Gels are the conventional approach. All of the phase three microbicides are gel formulations. Films are being developed by a number of groups. Solid dosage forms or suppositories are also being developed. There's also activity in the area of devices, and vaginal rings, which is what I'm going to speak about today, is one area where there's a lot of excitement and a lot of interest. Sponges have been around for a while and have effectively delivered contraception. And the diaphragm, being used with perhaps a gel, is another area that's being explored as a potential way to deliver a microbicide entity. Also, there are oral options for the prevention of HIV, but I won't be speaking about those at all today. So vaginal rings, they've been around for a while. They've been successfully used for other indications, contraception, hormone replacement therapy. There are a number of advantages to this technology. The first is it allows for sustained delivery of drug for extended periods of time. You can go, there's a ring on the market now that it goes in and stays for 90 days, which is a significant advantage. Potentially, it reduces the compliance burden for the user. This can go in and stay in. It's not something that has to be used with intercourse or on a daily basis. Once it goes in, it can stay for 30 days and effectively deliver the drug. Typically, they're very easy to use. They're just inserted, nothing complex, no applicator as is needed for a gel or other issues that can complicate it. And they are low cost. As you saw in Robin's previous slide, you need one ring for a month or one ring for 90 days versus a very large number of potential doses of a gel formulation. There are some unknowns with this technology, particularly as it applies to microbicides. There are a lot of published studies on the acceptability of vaginal rings in North American and European populations. There are none, or if there are, I'm not aware of them, on global southern populations. We don't know what the acceptability of a ring would be in the high incidence HIV areas of the world. Depending on the configuration of the ring, and there are different kinds of rings, there could be scale-up complexities. It could be simple, but depending on the type of ring you're doing, it could provide some challenges. Combinations in rings are something that need to be explored. Combinations are just being initiated in terms of their development in gel configurations or other dosage forms. The same is true here with rings. We don't know much yet about how to get more than one drug into a ring. Lastly, there's an environmental impact or a potential environmental impact. Depending on the matrix that the ring is made out of, the compound that the ring is made out of, it may not degrade. You can't burn it. You can't get rid of it. And you may have a buildup of a large number of rings in certain areas of the world if there's not an effective way to get rid of them. Here's a slide that compares some of the two fundamental types of ring technology. This slide is based on Warner Chilcott technology, which is the technology we used for the rings in our trial. Reservoir versus matrix. We use a reservoir ring, and I'll explain that first. Here is the basic ring structure, its shape. It's the same whether it's a matrix type or a core or reservoir type. The difference is that in a core or reservoir ring, there's an internal portion. So this is a cross-sectional cut of the ring where the drug is localized. And you would go to a core configuration if you want to impart some kind of diffusional control on the release of the drug. So the drug is located in the core, and then there's an external sheath, which is non-medicated. And depending on the configuration of the core, the concentration of the drug, and the composition of the sheath, you can regulate how the drug is released. Down here is a simpler format. This is a matrix-type ring, and this is just a polymer of some kind, silicone elastomer in our case, where the drug is just intermeshed completely with the polymer. Over here are some Raman spectrophotometry scans, and here you can see the orange, the dapivirine, which is the drug that I'm going to be talking about, TMC-120, localized in the core portion of the ring versus being interspersed throughout the matrix of a reservoir ring. So TMC-120 or dapivirine, that's the drug that I'll be speaking about in the ring trial that we conducted last year. TMC-120, as you saw in Robin Shattuck's earlier talk, is an NRTI. It was licensed to IPM from J&J in March of 2004. It was originally intended to be developed as a therapeutic. It's been a number of trials orally, so there's an excellent safety profile, systemic safety profile for this drug. It's well established. It is a very potent ARV. Its activity, EC50s are from the high picogram to low nanogram range, depending on the system that you're looking at. It's low cytotoxicity, non-mutagenic, non-teratogenic, very readily, easily manufactured, and it's very inexpensive. It is a stable drug substance, which is another advantage for a microbicide, whether it's in a gel or in another formulation format. We do have it as a gel. We have gone through some clinical trials with that, phase one trials. Those trials are in the analysis stage. And we'll continue to do gel development as well. So first, some in vitro data on the ring. These studies were conducted at Queen's University in Belfast, where these rings were fabricated. Again, this is with the reservoir ring. It's a silicone elastomer, Warner-Chilcott technology. Four different concentrations were established in independent rings, and these rings were put into classic dissolution-type experiments. And the amount of drug released per day was measured by an HPLC assay. What we see is that at the highest concentration, the 100 milligram ring. There's an initial burst that's up here in the high 200 micrograms. The other concentrations are not very different in the early time, a little bit more in the first day of measurement, but not so much more than what was seen released continuously over a 30-day period. So what we saw was that between 50 and 70 micrograms are released per day in vitro in the system that was used here. And just to give you some perspective, the EC50, the lowest EC50 for this drug is 0.33 nanograms per mil. The oral doses were in the hundreds of milligrams per day. So this is well within the safety interval that we have from the oral studies. This is just another way to look at that same data. It's cumulative release of dapivirine from the same ring. So you just add what you got out each day through the course of the 30-day period, and you see a very nice progression here up through the 30 days of the total concentrations of drug. What we wanted to do in our ring study was see where this drug went, how long it was there for, and what levels, what quantities were there. We had some PK data from rabbit studies, which was interesting and promising, rabbit and macaque studies from our gel. And just to give you some background there, what we were able to find were that there were tissue-associated levels of dapivirine well in excess of the EC50 after application of our gel, and those levels were maintained for at least 24 hours. There was good distribution throughout the vagina. We were able to find it in the cervix as well as in the introitus. Very low levels in plasma in rabbits. In macaques, we didn't find anything. There were some questions earlier about absorptions with the gel that we used. We did not see anything in the plasma with a very sensitive assay, 5 picogram per mil assay. We have a human PK study that was just completed. That data is under analysis. And now I'm going to talk to you about the ring study. So this study happened in the summer of 2005. It was a 7-day study. It used the reservoir silicone elastomer ring to deliver TMC-120, dapivirine drug. Main objectives, there were two. One was to assess safety. Now, there was very small numbers in this, so we knew we weren't going to get statistically significant safety data, but we had to look. This was a first-time ring delivery for this drug for us. Here was our major objective, to determine the concentrations in vaginal fluids and associations with vaginal tissues, as well as in plasma after 7 days of ring use. There were 13 women in the trial, 10 using 25 milligram dapivirine ring, reservoir ring, 3 using placebo. These were healthy, sexually abstinent women, ages 18 to 50, median age was about 26, who agreed to remain sexually abstinent and use oral contraceptives during the course of the study. I have two slides to summarize the safety, and the profile was quite favorable. The rings were well tolerated. No consistent or clinically relevant changes. Clinically relevant changes in lab parameters. There was one lab abnormality, hypokalemia, which was probably not related to the drug. No clinically relevant changes in urinalysis or vital signs parameters. No mean changes in vaginal ecology or in pH as determined by Nugent scoring. Two differences noted over the course of the trial, nothing very significant. One clinically relevant abnormality on pelvic exam, which occurred on day 14, which was 7 days after the ring was removed. It was the follow-up visit and after biopsies had been conducted. And it was seen by the investigator to be doubtful as drug-related. Here's a summary of the adverse events, just by group and by type. Again, the majority of these AEs were grade 1, mild. 3 subjects with grade 2, moderate, but were doubtful of being related to the drug. 4 subjects possibly related to the drugs, but none were considered very likely to be related to the drug. No deaths, SAEs, or AEs resulting in discontinuation. The major AE was vaginal bleeding. It was seen in both groups, and it was seen after the ring was removed in, I think, 5 out of the 6 participants who had that AE. And it was a grade 1, mild vaginal bleeding. In terms of finding the concentrations and location of the drug, we looked in plasma at 4 hours, 24 hours, and 7 days, while the ring was in. Snow strips, which are an absorbent paper-type mechanism for sampling vaginal fluids, were used at the same time intervals. We had some subgroups where less than the full patient population were looked at. Biopsies were taken after using a general anesthesia, very light general propofol, general anesthesia, and we took biopsies after ring was removed from the introitus, the vaginal wall area near where the ring was implanted, and the endocervix. These were the same areas where the snow strip fluid assessments were made. And here's a summary of all of that distribution data. So here's the dapivirine group, and we'll start with the tissue concentrations that were seen at 7 days. These are the geometric means. So there were 10 results that went into these geometric means. This last one in the cervix here, we only had 6. We lost 4 samples because they were supposed to be part of a substudy that didn't get conducted. And what we see here is that the geometric means are very high. These are nanogram per mils or nanogram per grams. And if you compare that to a nanogram per mil basis on the EC50, it's a very high interval of what's needed to inhibit virus in vitro. If you look at the vaginal fluids starting at 4 hours and moving out, you see kind of the same results. High levels associated with the fluids in each of the areas of the vaginal vault, all at relatively high intervals of the EC50. What you don't see are levels in plasma, which was a good thing for us. We didn't want to have systemic absorption or distribution of this drug. We wanted it to stay in the genital tract. And you can see that these levels are quite low compared to the other levels seen throughout the course of the assessments. This is another way to look at that same data. This is bar graphs. The bars here are the geometric means that were presented in the previous table. These are not error bars. These are the highest and lowest levels of drug that were seen for the individual participants. Everyone had drug in each of these compartments. There were no zeros that contributed to the means, and there were not radical differences between the highs and the lows in each of the compartments used. Plasma didn't make it onto this scale. This is a log scale over here, and you saw that there were the picogram quantities associated. This is the snow strip data. It's the same as what's in the table, except I've added the days 2, 3, and 5, where subgroups from the total group were looked at. And what we see here is that the vaginal fluids associated with the mucosal surfaces that were studied had about the same levels of drug throughout the course of the study, which was, again, something that we wanted to see. So, conclusions. TMC was delivered via vaginal ring at high multiples of the EC50. And it was delivered throughout the genital tract, or at least in the areas that we looked. It was detectable, but very low in the plasma, near the lower limit of quantitation for the assay, which is 5 picograms per mil. Both active and placebo rings were safe and well-tolerated. Next steps for us with this technology, we would like to and have to do a ring acceptability study in Africa to get some information about the relevant populations where this would be used. We need to expand the safety studies. Clearly, this was a small study in terms of time and number of participants. We want to look at alternative ring designs. So this was a reservoir. We would like to look at a matrix. And we want to investigate fully the manufacturing capacity issues that are around ring production for use as microbicides. I want to acknowledge the various groups that participated. There was the University of Ghent, where the trial was conducted, Queen's University, which did a lot of the ring development characterization work for us, Warren Chilcott, which produced the rings for us, Tibotec, which was a co-sponsor of the trial, and the group at IPM. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
I just wanted to ask I'm assuming that the vaginal bleeding with the removal was only with the active rings, is that correct?
No, it was seen in both placebo. There were 6 people who had minor vaginal bleeding, 4 in the treatment group, 2 in the placebo group. And there were only 3 people in the placebo group. The thinking is that this was related to the oral contraceptive use. I think for 4 of the 6, I don't remember the number, that was the time when menses was supposed to happen anyway. Maybe it was even 5 of 6.
It just seems a little worrisome, so I'm assuming that in large you're going to work. Oh, so pay attention
certainly
to that
do it, yeah.
Because it would be unfortunate to decrease risk while you're using it and then increase it after.
Mm-hmm. May I ask 2 quick questions?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All right.
Of course. All right.
This could be my naivete, but why is it, does the ring fit over the ectocervix? Is it flexible? Is it firm? Does it compress? I mean, why is it a ring? Is that why it stays?
Okay. I'm not the right guy to ask about fitting things onto the ectocervix. But it is a flexible ring. It is a flexible ring. And that helps with actually getting it in. And my understanding is that it's pretty much by tension that it's held in place in the area where it's inserted.
And that tension doesn't cause any ischemia or anything?
Apparently not, no. There are the women who are using the same ring for 90 days.
Yeah. And maybe you said this in the presentation, but I don't recall if this agent is active against efavirenz, navirapine resistant isolates?
It has a very favorable profile against those. There's a lot of the T-protect guys who have done some of that work, and there's strong activity still. There is a reduction in activity, but it's still meaningful.
That's great. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Joe, the PK data that you show, you only presented the mean. Did you find a lot of variation? I mean, I'm pleasantly surprised that you found high concentrations in the introitus, for instance, which would mean that perhaps you really have a good absorption all around the vaginal wall. But how much variation did you get in all the samples that you took?
Yeah, the two figures showed the highs and the lows. So on a log scale, they were less than an order of magnitude difference between the highest and the lowest. I don't remember exactly how tight they were, but the one figure that I had with those error bars, that gave you some idea of what the variation was between the highest and the lowest around the geometric mean for each of those.
My first question.
Look in here and then to you.
Okay.
Number one first, yes. And number two. Okay.
Mohammed Saifuddin from Conway. Actually, the results are great in terms of bioavailability, particularly you said exactly what you wanted. I was wondering, in rings, actually you got very low bioavailability. The first question was like, why do you see so low bioavailability? And then second question related to that, did you try the gel formulation, and where did you also see similar type of very low bioavailability?
Okay, the probable mechanism for the low bioavailability is probably due to the extreme hydrophobic nature of this compound. It's very water insoluble. We think it likes to go in tissues and find hydrophobic domains where it resides. In terms of a gel, yes, we did do a PK study larger than this study. Those results are actually in recently and are still being analyzed. They remain blinded at this point. But we will have gel data as well.
One last quick question, please.
Quick question. The ring itself induced pro-inflammatory cytokines, and what about the compound? If you put compound, does compound induce pro-inflammatory cytokines?
Okay, we've not done studies to look at the induction of pro-inflammatory cytokines with the ring. The compound is in analysis in the group at Mount Sinai, Betsy Harrell's group, who's looked at it in a gel formulation, and it has a very favorable profile there, particularly relative to other microbicides. So that data, I think, she may have presented at Cape Town. And should be coming out publication soon.
If it's really quick.
It's a very quick one. Tobias Lupa, my name. I was wondering, you were mentioning you were making licensing agreements with T-protect, and I guess that's always the case when these studies are happening. What kind of agreement are you making so that the product in the end will be really accessible for the poorest of the poorest in need? Can you just elaborate on these agreements? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have a final agreement with Warren Chilcott, but our approach with all organizations that have technologies or drugs that we need is the same, and that is we seek non-exclusive access for the developing world, seeking minimal cost with the understanding that someone has to make some money on manufacturing, but those are inherent features of the agreements that we put in place, whether it's for a delivery technology or the drug itself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So our next speaker is Shehzad Iqbal, who's going to talk to us about TRAPIN2, discovery of a novel inhibitor of HIV. So I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for the opportunity to present some of my thesis work that I've been working on at the University of Manitoba under the supervision of Dr. Frank Plummer. To begin with, I'd like to briefly introduce the cohort that we've been working in over the past two decades. First established in 1984, the Pumwani cohort is based out of Nairobi, Kenya, and it's quite a well-known cohort of a natural history study of the immunobiology of sexually transmitted infections. And specifically HIV transmission. To date, there have been approximately 2,200 enrollees, of which currently we are following about 800 individuals. The HIV prevalence in this cohort
is currently around 80%, and the annual incidence rate of seroconversion is approximately 15%. Now, it was about a decade ago that Keith Folk first published in The Lancet in 1996 that what we first noticed was that there was a particular subset of individuals that seemed, despite high rates of exposure on a constant, almost daily basis, particular individuals within this group did not seem to seroconvert. And this particular figure has actually been presented a number of times at this conference, so I'm going to briefly go through it. But essentially what it is a plot of the new enrollees in the cohort who are initially HIV uninfected and the time that it took for them to seroconvert. And what you can see is that the vast majority of them will seroconvert within the first 3 years of active follow-up within our cohort, and that as time goes on, there's a reduced incidence of HIV seroconversion with increasing duration of follow-up. And in fact, some individuals that we've now been following actively for over 20 years still haven't seroconverted. And it's that particular group that we are most interested in. And over the past 10 years now, we've been publishing a number of particular correlations of factors that we think are associated with HIV resistance in the sex worker cohort. And I'll briefly mention that there have been shown particular genetic associations of protection. But more specifically, and what I want to emphasize today in my particular talk, is that at the genital mucosal level, there have been found specific cytotoxic T lymphocyte HIV-specific responses, as well as antibody responses to HIV. And most recently, we also published that there was a noted high level of RANTes within the cervical lavage samples in a small study that we did last year. So with all of this, we formulated a hypothesis that perhaps the HIV-resistant women are being protected from infection at the genital tract level, and therefore that potentially innate immune factors mediating natural immunity to HIV infection may be found within their cervical secretions. And those of us who study mucosal immunology know that oftentimes experimentally it's very difficult, especially in human studies, to collect a large amount of sample volume, and that secondly, current immune assays are actually quite limited in their sensitivity of detection. So what we did is we started to evaluate a number of different technologies or different approaches that we could use to characterize the proteome of these cervical lavage samples, and the goal of which was to look for both known immune factors as well as potentially unknown immune factors that may be related to HIV resistance. And I'll get into this technology in just a moment, but to introduce the study groups that we used, over the course of 2 years, we collected almost 600 cervical lavage samples from three different study groups. These were the HIV-resistant individuals who are defined in our cohort for the purpose of this study as well as others, that there were 3 years of they are HIV negative for 3 years of follow-up during active sex work. And we compared them to HIV uninfected individuals who in our cohort tend to be new enrollees. So keep in mind when you look at some of this data later on that some of these individuals in the HIV uninfected group are in fact going to go on to meet our definition of HIV resistance, whereas the majority of them will fall into this final group, the HIV infected individuals. We also collected a large amount of correlating epidemiological and clinical data for the purposes of looking at potentially confounding variables that would apply to our biological findings later on. Now, in order to look at the proteome of cervical lavage samples, we employed a technology known as Seldetoff MS, or Surface Enhanced Laser Desorption Ionization Time of Flight Mass Spectrometry, which is a mouthful, to say the least. But what I'll do is break it down into two components. The first is the Surface Enhanced, or the SE. And this is essentially found on a protein chip array, which essentially has a chromatographic resin, which enables you to bind particular proteins out of a cervical lavage sample, so that some chromatographic resins will, for example, pick up just cationic proteins, whereas others will pick up hydrophobic or hydrophilic interactions. The advantage of using this technology, then, is that it reduces the sample complexity of the cervical lavage samples so that you can start to break down or fractionate the samples on the chip surface, essentially. You wash it away and insert the remaining protein that is bound to the chip surface into a mass spectrometer, which essentially, when you fire a laser, will ionize the sample and eject the protein off of the surface of the chip and down a time-of-flight mass spectrometry tube, or which is essentially a vacuum tube that has a detector at the end. The time at which, or the time, or the rate, sorry, that the proteins hit the detector is proportional to the size of the protein, so that the smaller the protein, the faster it'll hit the detector. And what you get at the end is a spectral view, where each individual peak represents one protein that was bound to your cervical or to your chip, and that the size of that peak is representative of the relative abundance of the protein in that sample. So when we ran all 600 of those cervical lavage samples and then began to do even just a basic analysis looking for HIV-resistant biomarkers, or essentially proteins that are exclusively upregulated or downregulated within that particular study group, one protein in particular showed up as highly significant, and it was at 6 kilodaltons in size, exclusively upregulated when compared to the HIV uninfected and infected individuals. Graphically, when we plot all of these samples, what we see is that, again, the HIV-resistant individuals had a statistically significant elevated expression of TRAPin2, again, this is on a logarithmic scale, of about a twofold level increase in that 6 kilodalton protein compared to the HIV-uninfected individuals, and threefold compared to the infecteds. And interestingly enough, there was no statistical difference between the infected and the uninfected samples. Now, keep in mind, again, that some of these uninfected individuals in time will go on to meet our definition of resistance. And in fact, anecdotally, during the course of this study, two individuals who had a low expression of this particular protein actually did seroconvert and became HIV-infected. Now, the next step is, of course, to identify this protein. What is it? And it turns out that using tandem mass spectrometry, we identify this protein as TRAPin2. Now, TRAPin2 is a unique protein in humans. Structurally speaking, it has two particular domains. One at the C-terminus called the WAP domain, which is thought to be its active domain. And at the N-terminus is a transglutaminase domain, which is thought to confer a certain amount of stickiness to this particular protein, enabling it to bind to other proteins into the interstitial milieu, so to speak. Interestingly enough, in the literature, it has been described as essentially having an antiprotease function with three particular forms. At the 12.3 kilodalton size, it's a cell-associated form, whereas there are two secreted forms, a 9.9 and 6 kilodalton size. And again, it was the 6 kilodalton size that of the protein that we identified as being associated with resistance. It is a mucosally derived protein and produced largely by epithelial cells, and possibly in some studies has been shown to be produced by macrophages. And also in a limited set of literature, it has been shown to have antimicrobial activity as well as anti-inflammatory activity. So in order to complete this story, we had to do two things. The first was to confirm the elevated expression of TRAPin2. The second thing, and perhaps the most important part, was to determine its biological relevance to our hypothesis. So in fact, does TRAPin2 actually inhibit HIV? So to address the first part of this, we developed an in-house ELISA system to quantify the TRAPin2 levels within the cervical lavage samples that we had collected before, and again showed that the HIV-resistant individuals showed a significantly elevated amount of TRAPin2 compared to our infected as well as our uninfected sample groups. And again, keep in mind this is a logarithmic scale. And also that there was no difference between the uninfected and infected sample groups. But perhaps most importantly, we do show, or did manage to show, that TRAPin2 actually inhibits HIV. Now, when we first started these experiments, we didn't actually know how TRAPin2 could possibly work. Was it binding to the virus itself and inhibiting infection, or was it actually binding to the potential cell targets and preventing viral entry or viral replication, things like that? So in an artificial T-cell line, what we did was two experiments, and I'll walk you through both of these. On the left-hand side is an HIV infection. Here is the positive control. So basically this is, again, virus and cells added together, and the maximum amount of viral replication is detected. And in this case, we're looking at reverse transcriptase activity. When we pre-treated the cells with TRAPin2, otherwise known as actually elafin in some of the literature, with just 1 microgram per mil, we added the protein in for 1 hour, washed it away from the cells, and then added in the virus, you start to see a decrease in the amount of viral replication. And in fact, when you increase the dose to 5 micrograms per mil, you actually knock down the infection even greater. Now, that was just with a one-hour pretreatment of the protein on the cells before we added the virus in. What happens if we actually keep the protein in the viral culture system for 6 days of culture as these samples were taken? And again, on the right-hand side, this time looking at a P24 output, again, what we're seeing is cells plus virus, and with a negative control, cells plus virus plus an antiretroviral drug. And then also a one-hour pretreatment of TRAPN2 at 1 microgram per mil. It didn't seem to show very much effect, but boosting it up at 5 micrograms per mil, you start to see a decrease in the amount of infection. And in fact, if you re-add the TRAPN2 into the culture system, you actually further reduce the amount of infection. So in summary, we hypothesized that the mechanism of HIV resistance occurs at the genital mucosal level and that these women would exhibit a phenotypic or characteristic proteomic profile of their cervical lavage samples. We used a novel technology to actually screen the proteome of the CVL samples from the HIV-resistant women, and we're able to find that there were a number of potential biomarkers of resistance, but one in particular at 6 kilodaltons in size seemed to be particularly highly elevated within the HIV-resistant women. We went on then to further identify this protein as TRAPN2 and confirmed its overexpression by an ELISA system. And most importantly, we've shown that it has biological relevance to our hypothesis, so that this is a previously uncharacterized inhibitor of HIV, and that we feel, given its strong association with natural immunity to HIV, it may make an ideal candidate for a preventative microbicide, or at the very least, warrants further investigation. I'd like to finish by acknowledging a number of individuals who played a fundamental role in all of these studies. First and foremost, at the University of Manitoba, my supervisor, Dr. Frank Plummer, who's also my mentor, and Dr. Blake Ball, Dr. Zhaozhen Yao, Lillian Moranin, Zhuzhun Ao, and John Rutherford at the University of Manitoba for help with their experiments in viral replication, and viral inhibition, rather. At the University of Nairobi, Dr. Charles Wachihi, Joshua Kimani, both who are instrumental in organization of this at the Nairobi end and also for sample collection, Tony Kariri, and of course the clinic staff, Jane, Elizabeth, and Edith, who are just phenomenal. At Cyphergen Biosystems, Dr. Brian Pack and Vladimir Pultz, who were a great help in developing the mass spectrometry end of this project, and also to the funders, the Canadian Institute of Health Research, ICID program, CANVAC, and NIH. And finally, and certainly a great deal of amount of thanks needs to go to the women of the Pumwani and mother-to-child transmission cohorts of Nairobi, Kenya, whose ongoing support and passion for this project makes all of this possible. Thank you.
So I'd like to start the question session by asking you whether you've had the opportunity to look at the breadth of activity of TRAPN2 against primary isolates.
So those studies have begun, and in fact, we are working on them currently, testing against both Kenyan isolates as well as other lab-adapted strains.
And do you know anything about its activity against different phenotypes?
At this particular moment, the experiments are actually quite preliminary. We have shown strong activity, but we need to do further activity to actually, or further experiments to keep characterizing it first before I can read this.
So what viral isolates have you confirmed activity against?
I'm just looking at my supervisor to see. We have looked at three Kenyan isolates that we've cultured through our cohort. They are both X4 and R5 type viruses, as well as some lab-adapted strains too.
I'm James A. Wu from Ambridia Biopharma in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Enjoy your presentation.
Thank you.
Just a quick question and comment. You showed antiviral activity in comparison with AZT. Mm-hmm. AZT has almost 100% inhibition of P24. Mm-hmm. And at the 5 microgram per mil, your protein, you see some inhibition, but less potent than AZT.
Yes.
But it seems to me the concentration is quite high. I'm just wondering, in your clinical samples, what is the concentration over there?
So between the in the ELISA systems, when we were measuring it by antibody-based systems, essentially what we were finding is that it's between 1 to 5 micrograms per mil concentration. So it's a protein that is at physiologically relevant levels.
Thank you.
Washington Cheng, German Primary Center, Kenya Medical Research Institute. I got a little bit confused when you talked about HIV resistance. I was wondering if you're talking of, if you meant lack of infection or lack of development of infection.
Okay, yes. To be clear, the HIV resistant women have never been shown to be to seroconvert, so they are HIV uninfected.
Yeah, then that brings me to the second question, because at some stage you talked about a few individuals who were previously defined as HIV resistance, and I've also been able to read a few papers here and there about the same cohort, who later seroconverted, and I was wondering how the people who have met the definition of HIV resistance would seroconvert. I'm definitely wondering again if you really tightened up your definition protocol to ensure that the people you defined as HIV resistant and uninfected were really uninfected, or the virus was simply sequestered in other hard-to-reach areas like the lymph node, the tear glands, and the rest. Did you ensure that?
No. Okay, so we don't have any evidence of showing that that the HIV infection is compartmentalized in any way in these women. Previous talks, they've actually emphasized this, so that these women are HIV uninfected despite high exposure, and we've looked by ultrasensitive PCR as well as clinically by serology, and consistently we show twice a year that we collect samples on these individuals and they are consistently HIV negative. Now, in terms of the, I think you're referring to a particular study known as the sex break study, which had shown that some of these individuals who were defined as HIV resistant went on after taking a sex break. So they went up country or something and took a break from sex work for a few months and then came back and seemed to have gotten infected. And we're talking about 11 individuals here. I believe it was 11. If not, it's 14. But essentially, we haven't looked to see how TRAPN2 would fit within the realm of that study yet. There is an ongoing study right now to follow up on that sex break study, and we are collecting samples to look at that particular question.
So if after a sex break, then they develop infection, that means they were harboring the infection?
No, they come back, they start sex work again, and then they get infected. Last question.
So you found levels of TRAPN in the cervical vaginal lavage, and you suggested that it's made by epithelial cells and macrophages. Do you have any sense as to what the levels might be in the interstitium within the tissues? Is it concentrated there yet? Any idea?
No, I don't have any idea. I mean, we'd have to start doing biopsy samples and things like that to really start hammering out exactly which cells are producing TRAPN2. And also because we're, interestingly enough, the form of TRAPN2 that is associated with resistance is, in fact, a secreted factor. So how is TRAPN2 actually cleaved? What's cleaving it? And why is it only that particular 6-kilodalton form, which at the moment seems to be the one that's associated with resistance? Don't know.
Thank you very much. I think
that's it.
Yes, thank you. Our last speaker for this session will be James Cummins from the Southern Research Institute, who will be speaking on a preclinical assessment of topical microbicides, development of a microbicide quality assurance program.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk today. And in fact, I'll be talking on behalf of Patricia Reicheldorfer, who was unable to attend the meeting. Before I begin with our goals, I'd like to throw out the idea of why do we need quality assurance in the development of microbicides? And I think yesterday in the plenary talk, it was mentioned the length of time or the process for getting a compound from the preclinical arena all the way through clinical trials. So how do we ensure that the best candidates actually make it to the clinical trial process? And in fact, this was identified as a gap by experts in the field. And tomorrow, the microbicide development strategy will actually be announced. And within this strategy, a major action item is the validation and standardization of assays. So in looking at our goals, to validate and implement standards of performance for existing and newly developed preclinical assays, to facilitate the development and application of preclinical methodologies that more accurately predict clinical efficacy and toxicity, to bring together experts in their respective fields to participate in MQAP projects, and I'll be describing these projects in a little bit more detail, to produce and disperse quality control materials and reagents, and then finally to maintain a database for microbicide data acquired through the MQAP studies. So who's who at the MQAP? I mentioned Pat Reicheldorfer. She's the person that has the vision for the quality assurance for this program. She has experience based in the past with the virology quality assurance program, and in fact we're being modeled after that program, and she is in the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. In NIAID, we have a consultant, Dr. Jim Turpin. Southern Research Institute is the contractor. This is a five-year contract, and we're currently beginning our fourth year. Brigida Beer is the co-PI, and Carol Ackman-Smith is our lab manager. Social and Scientific Systems maintains our database, as well as our website. Sean Muzoon is the project manager. And then finally, a very important component of the QA procedure is statistics. And we have Biostat Solutions as our statisticians, and Anna Bromley as the project manager. I won't go through all of these names, but we do have an advisory board that covers the full spectrum of the microbicides arena, whether it be quality assurance or those that are working in the field of microbicides, HIV, STDs, or in fact some of the industry partners that are working with us. I would like to acknowledge Jim Bremer at the VQA. I mentioned that we're modeling our program after his, and he's been instrumental in some of our projects that we're implementing. This is a list of our current ongoing projects. I don't really have time to go into a lot of the data, but what I would like to do is to tell you the study design or what we hope to get out of these studies, and then touch on some of the key findings that we found from these studies. The first was a retrospective non-oxidable 9 analysis. I think many of you are familiar with the Cole 1492 study and the fact that this compound was found to be toxic and potentially put women more at risk for HIV infection. So in looking at the historical data that was actually done by many labs, N9 is used as a control, whether it be an efficacy or a toxicity control. So we looked at 127 toxicity and 72 efficacy assays performed with 14 different cell lines or tissues and 5 labs over the last 6 years. And let me point out, with all of these groups, we're basically hoping to identify parameters that contribute to differences between labs and variability. The second group is the ex vivo tissue explant model. We had 5 labs that were using 3 tissue types, cervical, colorectal, and tonsil, and all of these labs in one degree or another were looking at activity of candidate microbicides and seeing how well these tissues worked as a potential screen for these drugs. For this particular set of studies, we felt like we wanted to do a comparison of in-house reagents, and in this instance it would be in-house virus and in-house medium, compared to that from a common source. And the common source in this instance was the Virology Quality Assurance Program. And then on the other hand, we wanted to know whether or not data generated in these labs, how well that stacked up against data that was actually performed in a central laboratory. And samples aliquots from these studies were sent to the VQA, and they were actually analyzed for P24 analysis. Many of you are probably aware that there's the lack of a surrogate marker in microbicide studies for safety, and cytokines have been proposed as potential biomarkers of inflammation or toxicity. So we had 12 labs that are currently evaluating cytokines, whether it be in cell lines or in actual biological samples that participated in our study. And in the first 2 studies, we looked at IL-1 beta and IL-6 in 4 different biological matrices. These included PBS, saline, human AB serum, and a vaginal fluid simulant at 2 different pHs. And I should point out that we spiked these samples so that a broad range of recovery could be examined. And we also used 7 different immunoassays that are commonly used in the field and 3 detection platforms to see what type of differences we would see. in the field of innate immunity, it's a somewhat unique field in the sense that some of the markers or potential biomarkers of inflammation, such as lactoferrin and SLPY, which is secretory leukocyte protease inhibitor, and perhaps TRAPin, we have this new one to look at, all these can be considered potential biomarkers for inflammation, but in and of themselves, they also have anti-HIV activity. So it could be that these could be proposed as natural microbicides. So we performed a similar study where we spiked known amounts of lactoferrin and SLPY into the same biological matrices, but each lab basically only used one immunoassay that's available for those. And then finally, we had a group outside of HIV that focused on herpes assays, and this was actually our first group to look at compounds that are already in clinical trials to see how well they worked and what type of variability we would see. We had five labs that used their own standard cell-based assay to look at the antiviral activity of two candidate microbicides and two control compounds, and I should point out that all of these were blinded in this particular study. This is a list of the members of our N9 working group. Brigitte Beard, SRI, was the group leader. The key findings, if you looked within an assay, which essentially is replicates within that assay, it was quite reproducible whether you looked at the same N9 concentration, the cell type, the assay duration, or the laboratory. Secondly, if you looked at the cell line, the duration of assay, and the N9 concentration between assays, so from assay to assay, that's where we did see variability, which is not really that unexpected. But what was rather interesting with the study is if you looked at all of the assays where there was 4 to 8 hours of N9 exposure, then the results were incredibly reproducible, almost too reproducible. And what we think this reflects is the fact that the efficacy of N9 is tied to its toxicity. So it is so incredibly toxic that the efficacy data, if you can call it efficacy data, was really tight and reproducible. And so probably a more interesting study would be to do the same type of retrospective analysis with some of the candidate compounds that are not toxic but do show efficacy, at least in preclinical studies. For those of you that might be interested in the statistics and the methods that were used, this work was recently published in Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy. This is a listing of the members of our tissue explant group. Leonid Margolis at NIH is actually our group leader. Again, this is a group of scientists that are using the three different tissue models, tonsil, cervical, and colorectal, to potentially look at the activity of candidate microbicides. I should point out that we also have the participation of industry, since we are about to examine activity of a compound and see how reproducible that is between the various labs. Now, I mentioned to you that we had a comparison of in-house reagents versus a common source of reagents, and we found that basically we did need a common virus stock to basically reduce the variability that is observed between labs, but medium was not as critical a parameter. And we also found that labs can pretty much perform their own P24 analysis. We did not need a central site to actually perform that testing. So with these two facts in mind, as I mentioned, we're about to perform a study where we've sent out a variety of viruses and the control and this one particular compound to be evaluated. For those of you that might be interested in some of the data, we presented this data at the recent Microbicides meeting and at the past CROI and ICAC meetings. At the end of the talk, I'll refer you to our website. We have the actual abstracts, the posters, and if there's a presentation, the PowerPoint slides available if you would like to look at that. This is the members of the Cytokine Working Group. Raina Fisherova at Harvard is the group leader. This is one of our largest group, given the amount of interest in cytokines as potential a surrogate for toxicity. We're now currently having our statistician compile the results. We have found some significant effects that were observed with certain immunoassays or matrix types. Some examples would be the recovery of cytokines was lower in serum compared to other matrices, not too surprising given the amount of protein that's in serum. Recovery of cytokines from a vaginal fluid simulant was similar to that from PBS and saline, commonly used for vaginal lavages. So this is good news in the sense that the sampling technique, it doesn't appear to be changing the ability to recover cytokines from this fluid simulant. And then finally, the pH effect appeared to be minimal and dependent on the cytokine preparation and the assay type. We hope to have a manuscript submitted soon on this so that you can see the type of statistics that were used for this analysis. Here are some of the abstracts that were recently submitted, and again, I'll refer you to our website if you would like to see some of that data. I mentioned the innate immunity group, which is looking at lactoferrin and Slippy. Charlene DeZutti is our group leader in Pittsburgh, and basically following the similar assay setup as what was done with the cytokines, we looked at these two factors, the recovery from the different biological matrices, and one interesting finding that we found was that in 5 of 6 labs that actually looked at recovery of lactoferrin from the vaginal fluid simulant, at the acidic pH, there was much lower recovery of lactoferrin at the acidic pH. So this has important implications on the sampling technique that might be used for a lavage. For instance, a PBS buffered lavage versus a saline lavage where there would not be any buffering. So clearly, detection of certain biomarkers could potentially be affected. And then finally, recovery of purified lactoferrin was higher in the vaginal fluid simulant compared to the PBS and saline matrices. So this is yet another parameter that suggests the type of matrix that's actually examined may have an effect on what you're measuring. Here's 2 recent abstracts for those of you who might be interested in looking at that data. And then finally, the herpes assays. Charles Isaacs in New York was our group leader. Again, I mentioned that this was the first group where we sent out blinded compounds. We had the participation of both companies that provided these compounds. And we learned from the explant experiment that the use of common reagents does reduce variability. So we sent out a common herpes virus stock, a common drug stock, and then a common cell type to reduce any assay variability that would be there. And so we really focused on the actual assay itself. And what we found was, depending on a drug's mechanism of action, different assay methods can influence the observed drug activity. And just to give you a bit more detail, the acyclovir positive drug control was inactive in attachment-style assays in which the virus drug inoculum is washed out. And basically, you know, one of the comments made from a lab where they did not see activity with acyclovir is, well, if we had just known that this was the case, we could have predicted this and we would have said something. But you have to remember that there are many labs who are screening compounds, and they may or may not know the activity or the mechanism of activity of that compound. And so I think people need to think ahead to how they might screen for these drugs so that you can possibly not miss candidates that could and of themselves might be good drugs further down the line. And this is our recent abstract from the Microbicides 2006 meeting. So I'd like to end with, this is a screenshot of our website, mqap.org. As I said, you can access all of our data if you go to the publications link, both the abstracts, the posters, as well as the talks. In terms of our management team, you can contact us through this link, as well as look at our advisory board and find out any more information about reagents that could potentially be sent out. I'd like to point out that the data that's acquired through our program will go into the Microbicide Research and Development Portfolio Database. I didn't have time to go into that, but if you click on this link, this will take you to their website, and you can basically find out more details about that. So I thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions? Yes.
Actually, I have 2 questions. I don't know to whom, but I mean, showing the whole session, it really shows that the microbicide is going ahead a lot. How do you assess the risk of resistances for people being not in microbicides, but people being treated with ARVs in using for microbicides for a lot of time? And the second thing is, as far as I knew, there was an attempt that microbicides should be a public good once they are developed and not under patent. Having the industry in it, how far is that thinking that they should be a public good?
Okay, I'll try to answer both of those. On the resistance issue, there's 2 concerns. One is that a resistance virus would be transmitted from someone who is positive to someone who is negative, and that the drugs being used would not be able to inhibit that event. The second issue is that you would have healthy women who were using these gels that have ARVs in them. You could get systemic levels of these drugs. At some point, they become positive and don't know it. Now you've got sub-therapeutic, sub-inhibitory levels in their body, which could select for resistance. The field takes both of those risks extremely seriously, as do the regulatory authorities. And what you're finding is that when trials are being designed, particularly phase three trials, there are sub-studies that are being designed to try to get to those questions. No one knows how much drug is going to be relevant for the selection of resistance. We don't have a lot of the answers that we would need to design a study to look specifically at this, but what's trying to be designed into phase three designs are ways to get to some of these questions. So the field is going to try to the best of its ability to get some of those answers going forward. On the IP side, again, the model that IPM has used is that the drugs or the technologies become available at no cost, royalty-free, non-exclusive for the developing world. So for them to sign that agreement, they're acknowledging that this is for public good. They're not looking to get a royalty back. So that's been inherent in the agreements that we've done. And we've actually helped other groups try to get similar agreements. So we have to compliment at least the corporate partners that we've had. They've been very, very cooperative in coming to terms with these types of agreements, and I think it's going to continue.
Why don't we go here next?
Hello. On your innate immunity panel, I noticed the names of a couple of very prominent microbiologists, and I wondered, do you have any plans, or are you working at all with studying the effect of microbicides on common cells in the female genital tract?
I'm sure those collaborators probably are, but from the aspect of the QA program, we're primarily focused on strictly microbicide for HIV right now.
No, I mean the effect of microbicides on.
You mean like lactobacilli and things like that?
Yeah.
That's actually being done through, there's a recently funded microbicide trials network. And one thing about us is we pretty much focused on preclinical, analyzing things preclinically. But then we're really broaching the point now where we need to start looking at biological samples. I've had a lot of people ask me about the cytokines, for instance, and cytokine samples. And when you get to biological samples, that's where you get to looking at things like lactobacilli. So what we hope to do is to work with the Microbicide Trials Network and decide who will do what. And they do have it's actually Sharon Hillier will be looking at that component.
We have a question over there.
Hi there, I'm Omar, and I'm a PhD. I don't have a medical background. The session was quite overwhelming for me. In a nutshell, if you guys can explain and let me know how far we are in getting this product out, and when would be, like, what is the stage that we are going to experiment on humans?
So currently there are several products in phase three trials, and they're due to finish in 2008 and 2009. Those are the first generation products. We don't know how effective they will be, but in the pipeline further behind are other products that are in development. So the short answer is we don't know how soon products will be out there. If the first generation is successful, it could be soon. If they're not, we'll have to do more work, but it's an achievable goal in a reasonable time scale.
Thanks a lot.
Michel Bergeron, Canada. What about the FDA versus counter drugs, out of the counters or prescription drug? Where are we at this stage? Because it's crucial, as we are working with agents that are specific for anti-HIV versus microbicides that have broad spectrum. So what's the status right now? Maybe Zita or Robin?
Well, I don't think we know the status for any of the microbicides, even the first generation, whether they will be over-the-counter versus prescription only. And how that applies to developing country settings, how that applies to other regulatory bodies, not just the FDA. So I think that will all evolve as the trial data come out and the submissions for licensure occur.
But what work is now being done towards going to FDA and other
agency different the world throughout the world to ensure that as we get these products in 2, 3, or 4, or 5 years, that we are ready, because it's really, it will require a change in culture here. It's quite innovative, microbicides. There are none in the market. So what is being done actively, because we wait until we get a product, we might have major surprises.
Well, there actually is a fair amount of work being done, but the regulatory authorities will not give you a definitive answer unless they see the data based on a specific drug. So there are lots of discussions occurring, but there is nothing that you can say definitively until they see a licensure package and they can react to the data.
Thank you.
I'm Patricia Simons from Brown University in the United States. I'm really interested in microbicides for many obvious reasons, but I'm wondering a lot about acceptability of women who, you know, people, we're talking about Africa, areas where people, well, for example, in Thailand, men like dry sex, so if a woman puts something inside, what's going to happen then? It's a very important issue, I think, to be answered.
In all the studies, acceptability is an important criteria that's being assessed. And also some of the preconceived ideas we have don't necessarily fit with the reality. So, for example, the issue of a dry sex was a concern to some groups. Now, I can tell you from experience in the UK microbicide development program, where they've started their phase 3 trial, they've been surprised that women who are a bit hesitant about using the product have actually been coming back and saying, my partner likes me using this. And so actually experience is what really determines acceptability.
Yes, and last question, please.
Yes, just a quick question. You mentioned 3 different platforms to evaluate your surrogate markers. What were they?
Well, it was ELISA, chemiluminescence, and then the Luminex bead-based technology.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you all for your attention.